Heroism is a word that's probably greatly overused. However, in a few instances, no other word applies. Early in 1945, a group of 121 volunteer U.S. Army Rangers dropped behind enemy lines to rescue 500 American and British prisoners of war from hell, a prison camp called Cabana Tuan. The soldiers there were the last survivors of the Bataan Death March. They were being bled to death day by day by overwork, disease, and brutality. The American army moving to get Japan out of the Philippines worried that the Japanese occupiers of the island would finally annihilate their prisoners outright as they retreated. The heroic story of that raid to free the prisoners and of the persistence of the men inside Cabana Tuan is one of the most overlooked sagas of the Second World War. Now Hampton Sides has written a book about those human stories, Ghost Soldiers. Mr. Sides, a contributing editor for Artside magazine, joins us from our studios in New York. Hampton, thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be here, Scott.
And why was this story overlooked for so many years?
Well, it's a very gruesome story, and it's an uncomfortable story to hear because it implies, in some ways, a national betrayal. Because we left these guys on the peninsula of Bataan without ammunition, without medicine, without supplies, and little by little, they were forced down into this neck of land, and basically, they starved to death. And that, of course, was just the beginning. They were force-marched 75 miles north in an incident that came to be known as the Bataan Death March. They spent 3 years in a prison camp. And I think to tell the story of the raid that liberated these men, you have to tell this uncomfortable backstory that Americans don't like to hear. We like to think that we're invincible and we don't lose wars. And I think also that the men themselves didn't particularly want to tell this story and sort of crashed the national party of our victory of World War II.
And let's explain. President Roosevelt and General Marshall and others made what must have been a difficult strategic decision, defensible perhaps, but they decided that it was necessary for the United States to, particularly after Pearl Harbor, to really concentrate most of its assets in trying to defeat the Nazi menace in Europe. And most of the Pacific Fleet assets, of course, were destroyed at Pearl Harbor. So they were caught in a tight spot.
Right. I don't, in the book, take them tremendously to task for this decision. I certainly wouldn't want to have been in their shoes. The master plan was, if they have to, they can retreat to the Bataan Peninsula, defend it quite well. This was a war plan that was on the drawing boards for decades. But what they had not counted on was that the Navy would be destroyed at Pearl Harbor. And that changed the entire calculus.
I think we've got to describe the conditions inside Cabana Tuan. It leaves you speechless to sometimes read the accounts of what went on there. This truly was hell. This was a place in which sickness was as great an enemy as brutality. Beheadings were not uncommon.
Cabana Tuan was an example of what happens when you bring a lot of diseased men together into one tight situation in the tropics, because you had a lot of diseases that really had been conquered by modern medicine. That kind of reared their head again and were killing, 50, 60, 70 people a day. Malaria, beriberi, dysentery, typhus, typhoid. And part of the reason for that is that the Japanese, and this is unforgivable, they denied access to rudimentary medicines that the Red Cross could have provided, that the Americans could have provided, and that were actually in storage on the island.
The soldiers, American and British soldiers inside Cabana Tuan, felt abandoned by the Allies. But in fact, the people, that camp became a very important concern to Americans who were planning the invasion of the Philippines, didn't it?
As the American army was advancing towards Manila, they realized that they were going to be heading right in the path of this camp. And there was a very important city, Cabana Tuan City, 4 miles away from the camp, where the Japanese were building up a garrison. And that was one of the great concerns, that as the American lines advanced, this prison camp was going to be right in the teeth of this battle.
Hampton, tell us, please, about the planning and then the execution of the raid. It was an extraordinary enterprise accomplished in just a few days.
They had 12 hours after they learned about the raid, they were on the ground. marching towards the camp. They had to go 30 miles behind enemy lines. And as you say, they had no time to rehearse this thing. They had to kind of wing it. So what they had to do is while they were marching and while they were on the ground, they had to really be learning on the fly. They started meeting with various Filipino guerrilla leaders who played a pivotal role in this mission and learned about the on-the-ground situation. And I can't overestimate the role that these guerrillas played. And I think to the extent that this raid drew headlines in the early days, the Filipinos were always left out. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a typical kind of American press, rah-rah Americans, completely ignoring and overlooking the fact that the brunt of the fighting was actually borne by the Filipino guerrillas. As soon as the gunfire started at the camp, there was an encampment of 1,000 Japanese soldiers. They sprang up and immediately charged the camp, and there was fighting that went on for a good hour and a half. The Filipino guerrillas had to really do the brunt of the fighting for the Americans while the Americans went in and extracted these guys.
The raid began in inky pitch darkness.
It was the kind of thing that they knew they had to have the element of surprise. There's no way it would have worked otherwise. And so they waited and they waited. And that for 4 or 5 hours, they are literally crawling through the grass under the noses of the Japanese guards.
You create in the book what the start of that raid felt like to the people who were actually inside the camp, who didn't necessarily think it was their liberation.
Right. The men inside Cabanatuan had been fearing that there was going to be a massacre, just as the U.S. Army had been fearing this. And when they first heard the gunshots signaling the beginning of the raid, they were sure that this was a massacre, the massacre they'd been fearing all these months and years. And they started crawling under their shacks and jumping into latrines and hiding behind buildings, really cringing in fear that this was the end. And it took a certain amount of convincing from the Rangers. You know, we're Yanks. This is a prison break. Head to the main gate.
How do you get 500 prisoners out of a prison camp without killing them in the process?
I don't know how they did it. You know, when you talk to the Rangers today, they say, well, you know, we were just doing our job, and they seem very unimpressed by the whole thing, and they're very modest. They didn't understand why I was so intrigued by what they had done. And I think that, you know, they forget how many things could have gone wrong. Mm-hmm. With all those bullets flying in so many directions, with 200 or 300 Japanese soldiers inside the compound, with 7,000 Japanese soldiers 4 miles away in the city, and another 1,000 1 mile away camped along the river. And then compounding that is the fact that these men, most of them, couldn't walk. How do you get prisoners 30 miles back to American lines? Well, this is where the lowly water buffalo plays a role. Mm-hmm. The Filipino villagers all around the camp had been bringing together their water buffalo and water buffalo carts and had assembled them at the banks of the river. And then they got in these carts and started pulling across the landscape like it was almost like something out of the Bible.
Hampton, when was it the story of the raid at the Cabanatuan camp became put on kind of an upper shelf of the story of World War II in the minds of many Americans?
Well, right after the raid occurred, there was a large story in Life magazine by the famous war photographer Carl Maidens, in which he said, you know, every child in America will learn about the raid on Cabanatuan. It's one of the great intrepid acts of American history. He felt sure that this was going to be like the Rough Riders charging up San Juan Hill. And I think a lot of people felt the same way, that this just remarkable, remarkable tale. The reason it didn't, who knows? I think that first, you know, several weeks after this raid happened, you had Iwo Jima. Mm-hmm. And then Okinawa and Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And, you know, the headlines supplanted each other, and each story was a little bigger than the next one. And then the war was over. And it's, for some reason, one of those stories that fell between the cracks.
And finally, Did you find that many of the men who were rescued, many of the men even who participated in the raid, were queasy, even sickly, reluctant to talk about that over the years?
Many of the wives of these men say that they never talked about it. They never mentioned any of these things to them until very late in life, when they realized that, you know, time was of the essence, and that they hadn't told their sons and daughters and their own wives these tales. They started talking, and it kind of opened the floodgates. I think this has been true for a lot of World War II veterans. They've been a pretty reticent generation and pretty modest generation compared perhaps to the Vietnam generation, until very recently, when we've sort of made them tell us their stories. But let me just say that there were several instances where these men stopped in the middle of their stories and just wept uncontrollably. And I wasn't prepared for the emotion.
Hampton, thank you very much.
It's good to be here. Thank you very much.
Speaking from New York, Hampton Sides, his new book is called Ghost Soldiers.